about considering this. This is a story that it is just the tip of the iceberg. Police in Albuquerque clashed with demonstrators protesting a recent spate of police-involved shootings, actually killings, this past weekend, as the city's mayor said that the situation had disintegrated into mayhem. The Albuquerque Journal reported that protesters threw rocks and at one point trapped some police in a vehicle and tried to break the windows. An Associated Press reporter saw gas canisters being thrown outside police headquarters and Albuquerque police deputies charging the protesters, which mostly dispersed the crowds. Protesters took to the streets in the afternoon and stayed out late Sunday after authorities declared that their protest was an unlawful assembly. People were angry over Albuquerque's police involvement in 37 shootings, 23 of them fatal, in the past 3 years. Critics say that far too many, not just far too many in aggregate, but as a percentage. This is a community. Albuquerque is about 500,000 people. The protesters repeatedly marched the 2 miles from downtown Albuquerque to the University of Mexico, holding up signs protesting recent police shootings. For example, Justin Elder, who was 24, held up a sign that read, "The Albuquerque Police Department is dressed to kill." He said that's what this police force is all about. Alex Sideritz, 23, said that he was participating in the protest because he was fed up with how police treat citizens. "It's reached a boiling point," he said, "and people just can't take it anymore." A shooting on March 16th, where a homeless man was killed, was captured on video. The killing occurred following a long standoff. Then last week, Albuquerque police fatally shot a man at a public housing complex. Now, this is not to say that all police are trigger-happy killers, but attitudes are changing on both sides of this thin blue line. Furthermore, between city, county, and state police, sheriff and highway patrol, the FBI, the ATF, and DEA, the DHS, Department of Homeland Security, U.S. Customs and Border Patrol, U.S. Marshals and Prison Bureau, Air Marshals and Transportation Security Officers, the U.S. Federal Protection Service and Military Police, the Secret Service, even SWAT teams, with all of them having their powers immensely broadened after the passage of the Patriot Act, America is becoming a police state and a war zone. The increase in police brutality in this country has become a frightening reality. Now, more than ever, captured on video that is available for the nation itself to witness. In the last decade alone, the number of innocent people killed by police, according to the U.S. Department of Justice, is 5,000. What do you think went wrong? Well, in the 1970s, SWAT teams were deployed a few hundred times per year. Now we're witnessing over 40,000 annual military-style police raids. You know, you got politicians that are overtly working against the Constitution, trying to take the very kind of weapons that were specifically designed to be owned and held by U.S. citizens away from those citizens. With all of those kind of weapons, assault rifles and even more powerful weapons, now deployed in the hands of police, federal and local, state police. The very thing that Jefferson and the framers of the U.S. Constitution and Madison wanted to protect against has become our reality. Then in 1994, the U.S. government passed a law authorizing the Pentagon to donate surplus military equipment to local police departments. As a result, the police in this country have become the fourth branch of the U.S. military with a clearly defined enemy. Any American who resists them or questions their authority. We have Glenn back on the line.
I'm on the phone now.
Yeah, Glenn, this is a serious problem.
Well,
we've become a police state.
Yeah, there are a couple issues. So first of all, it's bow hunting season for citizens, and the police haven't kept up on their annual licensing fee for their 00 status for license to kill.
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah, they're just fulfilling precisely what Obama said when he said we need a civilian, a force the same size as the military. You know, this is that, you know, multi-jurisdictional, multi-using center force. Yeah.
By the way, they are. You know how large? I mean, this is staggering to me. I did a study this morning when I read this article. To determine how many officers, gun-wielding officers with the authority to kill and arrest there are now in the United States. And it compares favorably with the U.S. military. Federal police employ 150,000 full-time enforcement officers authorized to carry weapons and to make arrests. The Bureau of Justice Statistics census of state and local law enforcement agencies, for those who love acronyms, the CSLLEA, says that there are 18,000 state and local law enforcement agencies. Collectively, they employ 1.2 million full-time officers and another 100,000 part-time officers collectively there for. There are 1.5 million officers, federal, state, and local, that carry firearms and that can make arrests of civilians in the United States. We have created a fourth branch of the U.S. military.
And more people in jail than any other country on earth.
By both percentage and aggregate terms. We have a serious problem. You know, after fighting 101 wars since this nation was first invaded, this land, by Europeans, America has brought the battle home. The new enemy? Well, all you have to do is look at the NSA and to see who they're spying on. The new enemy is the American citizen, the people of the country itself.
The people are an enemy of the people.
Yes.
And then plus we have some of these bizarre training things going on in Israel where I suspect that this attitude of dehumanizing the populace and seeing them as, you know, separate, you know, oh, you're civilians. Well, you're civilian. Yes. You're a civilian police officer.
Yeah, that was Jefferson's big issue. Is, you know, we've read so many times on this program what Jefferson had to say about the establishment of a military. And he said, you know, when you have the distinction between a federal or local official that is armed and has the authority to act on behalf of the government and civilians, when you make a distinction between the two of them, you've lost it as a country. Then your freedoms will quickly erode. And that's what we have done. We've created this difference between those who serve. We always love that term, that are in the armed forces or that are in our first responders, our police, federal, local, state. And there is now a distinction between the authority and the rights of those officials and those agents and the average citizen.
Well, and the FBI changing its mission, you know, emphasis from law enforcement to anti-terrorism.
Sure.
You know, and then that's directed at the people.
You know, that last year there were 17 Americans that were killed by Islamic terrorists worldwide. 17. And you know how many Americans were killed by police last year? 5,000. You are far more likely to be killed by your police department than you are by a terrorist. And also, under the guise of a mythical war, you can't fight a war against a tactic. There is no war on terrorism. It's a government myth designed to take power and freedom away from the people and money away from the people and to empower government agencies. That mythical war has led to the deaths of vastly more Americans than the battle against the enemy that kills relatively few.
It's bizarre. That, well, so on the one hand, they have the anti-terrorism emphasis, and on the other hand, we have this constant harping on tolerance, you know, which means that we have to tolerate anything they tell us, and if we don't, if we disagree with them, then we're wrong.
Yeah, we become the enemy. The enemy. It's the thing, by the way, that actually concerns me the most. Most of what, and I'm talking about now personally, because while we ought to be all concerned about the use of the U.S. military and how it has made bad things worse in Libya, in Egypt, in Syria, in Afghanistan, in Iraq, almost everything that we have touched, even in Vietnam, we made bad situations worse. You can even make the argument in the European theater of World War II. By aiding and abetting Stalin, we left Europe as bad, if not worse, than we found it. But the reality is that that while there are lots of things we ought to be concerned about, personally, the thing that I actually find haunting is the belligerent nature of police now. And how, because I am naturally inclined not to respect authority, because I know that authority is so corrupt and the judgment is so poor. Now, you know, you recognize that that police will come up now. They'll have their guns drawn. They will scream that you need to go spread eagle with your nose in the dirt, and they'll threaten you with your family there. And I'm not going to respond favorably to that. You know, I am just not going to comply with their orders, and therefore the likelihood of being shot by them is high. It ought to be a concern to every American. Unfortunately, I don't think it is. I think that we allow this kind of things to happen because we are far too apathetic. We'll return after the break. Welcome back to Shattering This. We've got Glenn on the line. We're talking about the change in America. Change in America to that which we used to despise. There was a time in America that Nazi Germany, with its Gestapo, was called a police state. We referred to the USSR as a military state. And yet, America's military is vastly larger than the USSR's ever was. And America's police is much more prevalent and much better armed than the Gestapo ever was. We used to refer to places like China as being a prison state because the number of people that were incarcerated, and yet America now incarcerates far more people than China ever did. And so we really become what we once despised, and most Americans haven't even noticed.
And then we use our prisoners as sweatshop labor for corporate call center operations and such.
Yes, it's prisoners are now used in all manner of things, and it would be far more if it wasn't for unions fighting back against it. I don't have any issue with defraying the cost of incarcerating somebody who is rightfully incarcerated by having them do productive work on behalf of society. It is actually limited because of the fact that unions have far more influence than do the Bureau of Prisons.
Nothing like a good old-fashioned chain gang, you know.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm not so sure the chain gang was the right way to go, but I certainly have no problem with prisoners working. I think it is I think it would be beneficial. I don't even have a problem with them being receiving some of their pay so that when they're released, they have the opportunity to survive independently for a while they're searching for a great job. My biggest issue with prisoners in America is twofold. One is that it has been said, and I happen to agree, that it is better that 1,000 actual criminals are set free than one just and innocent individual is falsely imprisoned. Now, I happen to support that notion, and I know that is not the notion that or a perspective that most Americans have. Most Americans are put the bums in prison and keep them away from me and lock them up forever. The other issue I have with the American prison system is that the preponderance of prisoners are in for drug-related crimes. And it is astonishing to me that we would continue to fight a war on drugs when we know that it is prohibition against drugs that that works so dramatically against a free society. We ought not be outlawing free choice. If somebody wants to poison themselves, if they want to drug themselves, they ought to be able to do it. It's stupid to do. I mean, I want to tell you, it takes every brain cell that I can muster to make a go of it. And the last thing I want to do is destroy my ability to think and to respond. But if somebody wishes to do that, why are we as a nation fighting a war against free choice? My only issue is if you choose to drink and get in a car, if you choose to be intoxicated and go to work and endanger other people, I've got an issue with that. And there ought to be lots of laws that punish that more appropriately, more strongly. That, you know, if you're arrested for drunk driving, it ought to be a serious offense. If you kill somebody because you were intoxicated, it ought to be a serious offense. And but somebody that chooses to use marijuana that's put in jail. You know, there's a case, Glenn, with one of the board operators here at GCN. When he was a young man in his late teens, he was caught with a very small amount of marijuana. He was attending a rock concert of some sort, had a small amount of marijuana. And that was a crime. And so this individual was jailed and then had a long probation period, but for what should not never have been a crime. I mean, using marijuana ought not be a crime. It is stupid to criminalize it. Long story short, he didn't have the transportation necessary and was trying to make a living, to work for a living, and could not report as required into this other state, which is where he was convicted for the marijuana possession. And therefore, he is considered a parole violator, and he's had his whole identity has been attacked by that jurisdiction, that particular state. He's lost his wealth. He's lost his privilege to obtain licenses. The state continues to haunt him. Just so destructive, so demeaning for a non-offense. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. And a related story, Dateline Kabul, Afghanistan. The United States is trying to sell or dispose of billions of dollars of military hardware, including sophisticated and highly specialized mine-resistant vehicles, as it packs up to leave Afghanistan after 13 years of war. It appears that the U.S. has finally realized that the Afghanis are not going to allow the Americans to stay while being subject to American jurisprudence. That's actually not American jurisprudence. It's the military. It would be the military court of justice. So we're packing up to leave. And when we leave, you know, when we left Vietnam, what we did with the helicopters is we just pushed them off the side of the aircraft carriers. And we simply burned up and destroyed most of the military hardware we used in Vietnam. Now the difference is that this stuff is really expensive. And we've got in Afghanistan now billions and billions of dollars worth of surplus U.S. equipment. And so what to do with it? Do you bring back a personnel carrier designed to protect troops against improvised explosive devices. These are our MRAPs. We have 800 of these things, mine-resistant, ambush-protected, armored vehicles. Do Americans want to see those things rumbling down our streets? So what are we going to do with them? Are we going to give them to the Pakistanis? The Pakistanis want them? Yeah, but the Pakistanis, they are the sponsor of the Taliban. They're the country that actually conceived the terrorist organization that we're allegedly fighting in Afghanistan. How could you give them to the Pakistanis? You're going to see the Taliban running around in U.S. MRAPs? You know, there's hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars worth of material that should never have been deployed. All it was used is to make a bad situation worse. Just think of the lives. We lost 2,176 members of the U.S. military that were killed in Afghanistan. For what? No, for what? The moment we leave, the Taliban will be right back in power. And it was this very Taliban that the United States, under the Carter administration, sponsored. We armed them. We rented them from the Pakistani government to overthrow the communist-backed government of Afghanistan. And now after putting them in business and arming them and empowering them, we go off and declare a war against them, which only pushed them out of Afghanistan ever so temporarily and into Pakistan. But from Pakistan, they'll return the moment we leave. It'll be like we hadn't been there, with exception of the fact that we squandered 2,176 American lives and billions of dollars that could have been spent on something productive in this stupid deployment of the U.S. military resources. Why do we celebrate a government that does this? Why do all manner of media spokesperson, whether they're announcing a sporting event or speaking on behalf of just the local news, talk about honoring the service men and women who somehow are concocted to have served American interests over in Afghanistan? There was no American interest in Afghanistan. We accomplished nothing. We made a bad situation worse. Why should we celebrate that? And now we want to dispose of $6 billion worth of non-military hardware, desks, chairs, tables, generators, in addition to well over $100 million of military hardware. What did we get for it? Why did we do it? And, you know, you look at Afghanistan, sure, we made a mess of Afghanistan. Sure, we made a bad situation worse. Sure, that was predictable. But look at Iraq. Oh, my God. Look what we did to that country. We go in and we depose the Middle Eastern dictator that is the single most effective against thwarting Islamic terrorism. There is no Islamic terrorism in his country. There is not a single Al-Qaeda operative in his country. He is at war with Islamic terrorism, and he is really effective at it. And we go in under the guise of the war against terrorism and depose him and create a situation where terrorism is more prevalent now in Iraq than it is in any other country in the world. We're on average 100 Iraqis are killed every day through Islamic terrorist attacks. On top of all that, we gave Iraq to Iran and enabled them to complete their nuclear ambitions. On top of all that, by empowering the Shias in Iran and giving them Iraq, which in essence also gave them Syria and Lebanon, we created the basis of the Syrian war, where now Sunni Muslims are trying to rein in the increased power and authority of the Shias. We've made a mess of things. Everything we've touched, we've made worse. You know, it's time, way past time, we stop this. But no, we're not willing to do that. Here's news out of Europe. To deal with the Russian annexation of Crimea, which was appropriate, was peaceful, was inevitable, was even consistent with 97% of the population of Crimea, and consistent with Crimea's history being part of Russia. We're having NATO respond. Now, if you want to start a world war between the United States and Russia, between Europe and Russia, this is the way to do it. Have NATO be the spokesperson. Reinvigorate NATO. Have NATO rattle their saber. Have NATO reposition their troops. You know, nothing that says war more than having military alliances start shouting against one another. And that's what we're doing. NATO Secretary General Anders Fogh Rasmussen ordered military planners to, quote, develop as a matter of urgency a series of additional measures to reinforce NATO's collective defenses, end quote. Against whom? Why? Because without firing a shot, Russia reclaimed what had been theirs for centuries with a referendum where 97% of the people said this is what we want, that a region of a country that has only existed for 20 years and has had two revolutions in the last 10, that has essentially mob rule at this point, that over this we ought to be rattling in NATO's saber against Russia? I mean, it's like we've lost all touch of reality in this country. And the senators and congressmen have voted almost 95% in favor of this stupidity. The Obama administration speaks out and orchestrates the chorus along this immoral, counterproductive, and unbelievably destabilizing lines. Now, the measures, according to NATO, would include sending NATO soldiers and equipment to NATO allies in Eastern Europe, holding more exercising, taking more steps to ensure NATO's rapid reaction force, that it could deploy more quickly, and a review of NATO's military plans as they are focused against Russia. So Russia has 30,000 troops in Russia along the eastern Ukraine, which is about half Russian, and was part of Russia for 300 years. And NATO's response is, you can't do that, that's provocative. So what we're going to do in response is we're going to send NATO soldiers into Eastern Europe and have them, with their equipment, hold maneuvers. That if what Russia is doing is inappropriate, how is what NATO is saying they're going to respond by doing appropriate? Have we lost, amongst military leadership and politicians, all ability to reason? And you're a complete hypocrite if you say Russia can't have its troops in its country, but NATO can have its troops in other people's countries. Facing off against one another. You think that's going to promote peace? As NATO ministers convened, Russia warned the Ukraine against integration with NATO, saying that Kiev's previous attempts to move closer to the defensive alliance had unwelcome consequences. You know, you can't take a region that had been part of a country for 300 years and say, now with a defense alliance, you're going to have that country go to the other side and expect the Russians to sit by idly while you promote that. And that is exactly what the West is doing. That is exactly what Europe is doing. And yet, it isn't in the U.S. or Europe's interest in doing so. Ukraine is a liability. It's not an asset. It will sink these nations that can't afford militaries further in debt. And don't mistake for a moment, NATO is the United States. Almost every country in Europe has hugely diminished its military spending and its contribution to NATO. NATO at this point is the U.S. under European command. The Ukrainian prime minister, could call him a prime minister, is a joke. He was not elected, has said that the country's new pro-Western leadership is not seeking membership in the Western alliance. Means that that's exactly what they are seeking. However, NATO is expected to step up cooperation with Ukraine's armed forces by training officers, holding joint exercises, and promoting control mechanisms. It's exactly what NATO wants. The integration of the Ukraine. They're still fighting the Cold War. This finally gave NATO a purpose. They've been goalless, missionless for years. And now they have a purpose. They can go after Russia again. This is a horrible move. It's astonishing that we find ourselves in this position. We'll return to this story when Shattering Myths continues after the commercial break. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. Perhaps having listened to some of the commercials that played during the last break, that they should do a bundle. You know, a bundle is where you get a discount by combining products that you purchase. You, after consuming the sugar-infused and alcohol-infused beef jerky, then you you buy your probiotics products to cleanse your body of those effects. It's as a bundle, beginning to make perfect sense. There is another story here from the Washington Post. It's the same story on what's happening with NATO and how NATO now is being used as the mouthpiece to demean Russia, which is just unbelievably absurd. But here's the Washington Post take on it, Dateline Brussels. An invigorated NATO flexed old Cold War muscles. Now, this is... You know, an arm of the U.S. government. NATO doesn't exist without U.S. Funding and without U.S. military hardware. That here is NATO flexing Cold War muscles when Obama got up on his soapbox just a week ago and said and demeaned Putin, saying that, you know, Putin is still in the Cold War. He hasn't gotten beyond the Cold War. And he said, oh, America has no interest in Ukraine, no interest in going back to the days of the Cold War. And Obama presented himself as, I'm above all of that. And accused falsely Putin of doing those very things, when in fact it's NATO that is returning to the Cold War, which, of course, the Obama administration controls. The North American Treaty Alliance chief recommitted to defending the Eastern European region and the Baltic nations. Defending them against whom? Although NATO has largely refrained from posting troops in nations on Russia's front, Rasmussen said that that's what we're going to do in the future. NATO is going to establish permanent bases in frontline allied nations, the NATO official said this week. So the way that we can demonstrate that it's inappropriate for Russia to have 30,000 troops on its border is that we're going to put NATO troops on the Russian border. Yeah, perfect. Seems so logical to me. So moral, so appropriate if what you're trying to do is to diffuse tensions. Two other comments from the Washington Post. It says NATO, formed as a U.S.-backed bulwark against the Soviet Union, has expanded in the past 15 years to include many Soviet satellite states. Over the Russian complaints, NATO sometimes invites Russia to attend sessions, but that was not the case this time. The United States has complained that it's funding a disproportionate share of NATO missions while European nations cut their defense budgets. The reality is there is no foe to that a military now can defend a nation from. There is no country in the world that is positioned to invade and occupy a nation that isn't immediately on its border. That's just the reality of the situation. The Russians aren't going to try to occupy the United States, nor the Chinese. They haven't the capacity to do so. Our military serves no purpose whatsoever in terms of ensuring the freedom of America. And to position militaries in these ways is counterproductive. You know, if you want Russia not to want to have influence over the Ukraine and Crimea, then don't incorporate former Warsaw Pact countries into NATO. And it's really pretty simple. You know, we are the antagonizer here. We're poking at the hornet's nest. Glenn, I know in the past you've had a lot to say about this, the whole mess of the Ukraine, the hypocrisy of the United States in this situation. Why do you suppose it is that there are so few people in the world, particularly in the West, that are holding Western politicians accountable in this regard? Because it seems like everybody is rallying around this notion that Putin is bad, Putin is the aggressor, the Crimean referendum was illegal, integrating a region that votes 97% in favor of reintegration is, without firing a shot, is inappropriate. Why can't anyone else figure it out? Well, after the commercial break, we will return to Shattering Myths. We're going to make a transition away from the news and to the prophecy about the news that Yahweh provided us with 2,700 years ago. So stay tuned, and we're going to return to Yashaya Isaiah 17.